On Tech News Today, the guy in charge of Beats One Radio is leaving Apple. Plus, a new app lets you stream live gaming commentary like Twitch, but from your phone. And the Pentagon wants U.S. soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen to be all they can be, so they're turning to Silicon Valley for help. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, August 28th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. And by Little Bits, the easy way to build electronics with modular building blocks. Go to littlebits.com/TNT and you'll receive $20 off your first kit, plus free shipping in the U.S. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is Mashable senior tech correspondent, Christina Warren. Hey, Christina, how are you doing today?
I'm great. I finally have
my pink watch
band. And it is a very soft pink. So frequent watchers of Tech News Today on Fridays will know that I have been complaining, as one of my followers on Twitter said, what will Film Girl complain about now? I don't know. I will find something.
Yeah. And didn't you buy that 20 seconds after the last episode of Tech News Today that you were on?
I did. Yeah, I did.
I saw it pop up on Twitter and somebody prompted you. It was.
So someone found it and I was like on it, buying it, spent, done. Yep.
Yeah. While you were doing that, we were sort of like watching it happen in real time on social media and in the chat room. So that was a lot of fun. So here's what's happening. Apple, of course, has its event on the 9th, and they're going to stream it for the first time ever to Windows users, but only users of Microsoft's Edge browser, which is in Windows 10. Christina, what does it all mean?
Well, okay, this is actually, I want to correct you, it is not the first time that they've ever streamed it to Windows users. Okay. In the past, if you recall, there was a period of about two and a half years when they made Safari for Windows.
Oh, yes.
The ill-fated Safari attempt. Yes. When Safari was available for Windows, they were able to also, you could watch the stream that way. And now they can do it with Edge. It's actually the same technical reason. So Apple uses a service called HLS, which is HTTP live streaming. And it's a spec that other people can use, but it's Apple's spec. It's part of QuickTime. It's something that's part of the QuickTime server requirements. It's built into QuickTime. It's built into iTunes. It's obviously built into Safari and built into OS 10, but it's also something that Microsoft has adopted with Microsoft Edge. So if you're using the Edge browser in Windows 10, you can use it. If you're on another version of Windows and you have iTunes or QuickTime installed, you can actually use VLC to watch the live streams. So that's a fun fact. But this is the first time in probably 4.5 years since Microsoft has had official Windows support.
So that's really interesting. So this isn't something Apple did. This is something Microsoft did.
This is something Microsoft did with Edge, right? By supporting HLS, then Apple can say, okay, well, Windows users can stream it too. It is notable, I think, though, that they bothered to mention, Windows 10 with Edge browser in the compatibility notes, because they typically don't do that, mentioning another company's services. So, that could indicate, obviously, that they have bigger plans for things that are outside of just kind of the traditional Apple ecosystem. And obviously Apple over the years has become more cross-platform for some of its iCloud services. Obviously iCloud.com works on Windows and works well on Windows. They have just some of the basic apps, including iTunes and some other things that work on Windows. I'm not expecting, though, for example, to see Pages or Keynote or any of that stuff to appear, but it's still interesting, and it's definitely good news for people who are on Windows, kind of tablet devices or the two-in-ones, to be able to know that, hey, if you're at work on a work machine and it happens to be running Windows 10, or you've got VLC, you can tune it and check out the Apple event.
So you heard it here first, folks. If you're a Windows user, please form a single file line to watch the Apple event coming up, and we'll be seeing the truck schedule and all kinds of other stuff, no doubt. Well, let's jump into the regular news. After being charged with European Union antitrust violations, Google struck back yesterday by telling regulators that they're just plain wrong, and on multiple levels, too.
Sam Schechner is the Wall Street Journal's tech correspondent in Paris and joins us now from Paris. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on at this late hour. Now, before we get into Google's response to the EU, can you review for us what it was they were charged with exactly here?
Well, this is a case that dates back to 2010, actually, and the EU has investigated a number of complaints from a variety of companies that have complained. They boiled it down to about four main complaints, and then they picked one of those to file charges on, and actually just a subset of that. And the charge is essentially that Google has taken its dominant position as a search engine in Europe, by some estimates it has 90% market share there, and used it to unfairly punish competitors in the sub-business of comparison shopping. That it's sort of used that power to muscle into that business and thwart competitors, which would be a violation of antitrust law. That's the accusation. Google says that it's wrong on many levels, as you said.
So what's basically, so they also appear to kind of slam the regulators for not showing evidence of their claims against Google. How fair is that, considering that the regulators didn't really have access to their algorithms or source code, or are they right?
Well, what they claim, Google, in this filing, I mean, this is part of the back and forth of any antitrust case. So it's the same thing that Microsoft went through. They send a set of charges, the company responds. And so what you talked about, saying that they didn't show backup for their claims, some could argue that it's not fair to the regulators, but it's actually not about seeing the algorithm. What they're saying is that in order to demand changes to Google's algorithm, which is what they say is basically what the regulators are asking, they say what the regulators are demanding is tantamount to asking us to change our algorithms, and doing so would require us to be so important to these companies like we were a utility, a gas utility, and that creates a very high standard in antitrust law that they say that the regulators haven't proven. The regulators would argue, and certainly some of the opponents argue, that standard isn't necessary in this case for Google to enact the changes that the EU wants.
So one of the charges that Google leveled against the regulators was that they just don't understand the online shopping business and how it works. What is it that Google was complaining about there that they misunderstood?
Well, so one of the three things, so that we talked about the, not having the legal justification. The other main argument that Google had of the three main arguments is that their economic analysis was completely wrong. That they say the EU looks at a search business that exists kind of on its own, where it's basically Google and then Bing and then maybe, some others. And that the comparison shopping business is a distinct singular business, and that doesn't reflect how people go shopping. That when I want to buy something, I type in Amazon, maybe I search on Google, maybe I also go to some shopping comparison engine. And that the fact that all of those entities are competing against each other makes for a much more dynamic business in which A, Google isn't dominant, so therefore couldn't be abusing its dominance, and B, where maybe it's a company like Amazon that's crushing these smaller comparison entities and not Google.
That's an interesting argument for them to make. I kind of love that they're being that brazen and making it. But basically, I mean, the EU's process is really slow, as most government processes are. By fighting them all the way on this, I mean, is Google basically just pushing this out as far as they can and to at a point where it might not even matter anymore, because we're all going to be ordering things not through, search engines, but by osmosis or talking into devices and pressing dash buttons and other things? Are they kind of taking advantage of the slow process by basically trying to fight this and push it out as long as possible before, the courts can force them one way or another?
Well, you make two really good points there. And one is certainly the slow process does play to Google's advantage. People close to the company, outside the company, say that. Google's, when they tried to make a settlement, was arguing that this is the best deal you guys are going to get. You really don't want to get into a contentious legal situation with us. Also, will the world have changed to the point where any remedies might be moot in the future? I mean, Google's argument is that the world has already changed, that maybe there was a time when people used search engines to find products, but none of those processes, you know, none of the products, whether it's Google's or the others, are particularly popular when it comes to buying stuff online. So they would argue the world has already changed. The one thing that won't go away, though, even if it's 10 years down the road, is the scale of EU's potential fines. And at 10% of worldwide turnover, that could be up to $6.6 billion currently. And that's not a joke, no matter how far out they push the process.
What do you think the chances are that they would levy that big of a fine?
I think that big of a fine would be very small chance. I don't know that they've ever levied a fine that's the full amount. But when they would look at what's the value of the businesses in question, certainly, you know, Microsoft ended up paying fines when they total it all up that went into the billions. So significant fines are, and antitrust fines are probably the strongest regulatory weapon that the EU has.
I'm kind of fascinated by the perception outside of Europe that doesn't understand the perception inside of Europe that tends to obsess around Google. The as you said, the market share there for search engines is above 90%. That's higher than just about anywhere else in the world, certainly in the United States, much higher than U.S. Among regulators, when they look at the – when they gaze their eyes across the many different violators of potential antitrust law, Google reigns supreme there too. They just have a kind of an obsession, in part because I think Amazon isn't as big in Europe as it is in the U.S., and in part because Google is so dominant in Europe, and in part because they're in so many different businesses and are so aggressive about harvesting user data, about using their algorithms, about mixing and mashing together different businesses together. So it's really interesting, and I think this is a special case for the EU and certainly one for Google. We'll see how it turns out. Sam Schechner is at WSJ.com and on Twitter at Sam Scheck. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I got some more news for you coming up, but first let's talk about Gazelle. You know what's happening in about a week and a half, a little bit more than a week and a half. Yeah, Apple's going to announce a new phone or two or four. And when they do, the price of the current phones that are out there that you already own, if you own an iPhone, is going to drop a little bit. That's right. If you're going to sell your phone to Gazelle, you're going to want to do it sooner rather than later, because as soon as the new one comes out, the old one loses a little bit of value. Sometimes a lot of value. It depends on the announcement, because, of course, lots of people want the new goodness. So I would recommend to you, this is my recommendation to you, go to Gazelle's website, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Go in there and find out right now what your current iPhone is worth and start the process of selling it to Gazelle. Because, of course, after the phone ships, and if you're going to get the upgrade, which I believe I am, I'm going to sell my phone to Gazelle and then get the new hotness, assuming that it's new and hot. That's the way to do it. Do it now. Don't wait until 2 weeks after the announcement, because, of course, the prices will be completely different. And, of course, if you don't want to upgrade to the iPhone 6S and you do want to upgrade to like an iPhone 6 Plus or something like that, a phone that's been around for a little while, buy it from Gazelle. You get a much, much better price than you would get if you were to go to, you know, the AT&T store or whatever, or the Apple store. Much better price. And it's fully functional. They make sure that every single phone works great, and they back everything by a 30-day risk-free return policy. So you literally risk nothing from buying from Gazelle. Find out what your iPhone's worth. Take a minute and go to gazelle.com to find out. And this is an awesome service, and timing is everything. That's all I'm going to say. The guy in charge of Apple's Beats One radio has left Apple, according to an exclusive by Matthew Garahan in the Financial Times. Ian Rogers was the former CEO of Beats Music when Apple bought it last year, and he came along with the acquisition. Now he's gone. Matthew Garahan is the global media editor for the Financial Times and joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Now, isn't Rogers the guy who hired Zane Lowe, and wasn't he the main creator of Beats One? And isn't he such a big Steve Jobs fanboy that his first ever tattoo was a Next logo? Why would this guy leave?
Big question, and very, very sort of murky at this point. We don't really know why. This was described to me by people who work alongside Ian Rogers as his dream job. He developed Beats One, nurtured it along, launched it. It was the one part of Apple Music, I think, that gained the most positive critical attention, and now he's going 2 months after launch. It's very curious. He has another job lined up, but it does raise some questions about what the motivation may have been for his departure.
Yeah, no, this totally, I'm going to admit, it took me by surprise. I've spoken with Ian a lot over the years, both when he was at Beats and now that he's at Apple. I mean, he was the person who kind of gave me like my, you know, media walkthrough of Beats Music or Apple yeah. Music rather, you know, right, you know, 2 months ago, right when that launched. So, I mean, what does this tell us about the success or the failure of Beats One specifically, since that was the main area that he was kind of overseeing? I mean, he had a lot to do with Apple Music as a service, but particularly Beats One. Is there any conclusions we can kind of draw from this move one way or another about what it means for the future of Beats One?
It's unclear, really. I think that what stood out was that the launch of Apple Music didn't go particularly well. I don't know what your view was, but from our perspective, it, you know, it was splashy, like a lot of Apple announcements. It didn't have the kind of the killer edge that a lot of previous Apple reveals had when Steve Jobs was CEO. Ian was, you know, Beats One since then has been the standout aspect of the service, and that was Ian's baby, right? I mean,
Right.
He's a music veteran. He has a pedigree with music and tech. As you guys say, you know, he has a Next tattoo. Such was his sort of admiration and reverence for Steve Jobs and for Apple. So it really is quite puzzling that he would leave so soon after the launch of the service. And it, you know, it's done really well. It's been very well received critically. I don't know how much you guys have listened to it, but it's a terrific.
It is. It's fantastic.
Service. Yeah, the music is brilliant. It's eclectic. It does everything that Ian told us that Beats Music was going to do: be more personal, be curated. Yep. Yep. And then, on the, you know, alongside it, and it's free. Alongside it, you have the paid Apple Music subscription service, which is so it's a sort of gateway into that, and it's been pretty successful. I think Apple said 11 million people had signed up for free trials in the first month, which is a pretty decent number, given that Spotify has something like 75 million active users. So where Beats One goes from here, unclear. But it is the sort of, you know, the shiniest, most positive aspect of the Apple Music launch to date.
Now, Ian Rogers isn't just a music person in general. His background suggests a certain type of desire yep. throughout his career to integrate fans in new ways with the musicians and with the music and so on. For example, he used to run Topspin. Can you talk about what Topspin did and just a little bit more about his career before Apple?
Well, he was a terrific Wired interview with him from a couple of years ago, which I urge you all to look up. You can probably Google it somewhere, but it was pretty revealing. You know, his three loves were his family, technology, and music. And he was coding. I think he comes from Indiana. Coding from quite an early stage, and a huge music fan, punk fan, Beastie Boys fan. He ended up doing a lot of work with the Beastie Boys, trying to help them develop a web presence, all before he started Topspin. The idea behind Topspin was to connect acts and talent with their fans wherever they were and help them, you know, get into other services, sell music, sell other merchandise, all that kind of stuff. And that got the attention of the Beats guys, of Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre. And when they were pulling Beats together before the Apple acquisition, Ian was one of the key hires. I mean, he came in, I think, a couple of years ago, and they put him in charge of the streaming service, and it was all him. Subsequent to that, Apple came in $3 billion and buys Beats. And they put Ian in this important role running Beats Radio, and now he's gone. So he's, you know, music and technology, there aren't many other people around who have that kind of credibility and have that grounding in music and technology. He's one of them, and I'm told he's leaving to work in an unrelated industry. He's moving with his family to Europe. I heard he might be working for a luxury company, not sure which one, but it's a big loss to music and it's a big loss to tech that he's going.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you had any idea what this industry was, but I agree with you completely. This is a huge loss to tech and to music and to Apple, I think. I mean, I've spoken with him many times over the years and have always really enjoyed him. And like you said, he's one of those few people that is truly at that intersection point of tech and music, which are two forces which are historically very diametrically opposed. I mean, he was part of a startup in the late 90s that was kind of doing, you know, was trying to make the Napster sort of thing, but legal, and doing a lot of things that YouTube and that streaming music and that Spotify, you know, is doing now. He was trying to do, you know, in the dial-up era. He's definitely has this great vision. And, you know, he was running the iTunes music kind of rebuilt Beats music from Moog, you know, from the ground up. A lot of that became the underpinnings for Apple Music. So no, I totally agree with you. This is a big loss, I think, for tech and for music. I wish him the best of luck, but,
he's credible too. You know, I mean, his music taste is kind of really out there. It's crazy, you know, punk hip hop, but very kind of edgy stuff. And I think he was involved in it. Yeah, he's always stayed true to that. He's not a mainstream music guy by any sense, but he likes edgy music and he has a broad range of tastes. So yeah, it is a big loss for Apple.
Maybe Dre is advising him to make a biopic called Straight Outta Cupertino or something like that.
Straight Outta Indiana.
So Matthew Garahan is at FT.com. That's the Financial Times website. And he's also on Twitter at Matt Garahan. Thank you so much for joining us today, Matthew.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
A new live streaming app called Mirative launched yesterday. Like Meerkat or Periscope, it lets you live stream through your phone's camera, but it also lets you screen share and do other neat tricks. Sarah Mitroff is a software reviews editor for CNET and joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Welcome. Hi.
So glad you're here. Now, what can you do with Mirative that you can't do with some of the other streaming apps?
Yeah, so it's a lot more like Twitch than it is like Periscope, but there's sort of all these analogies coming together because Periscope and Meerkat have been really big this year. But what Twitch lets you do is stream gameplay from your console or from your computer. So if you're playing a game, you can share that with your fans, explain what you're doing, and just show people, bring people into that experience. So what Mirative does is let you do that on your phone. Now, you could do this on your phone through Twitch, but you had to connect your phone to a computer. I mean, you had to use cables. There was many steps involved. This lets you do it completely untethered, live from your phone, and you can stream anything you want. So it's not just a game. Basically, once you turn it on, anything that's on the screen of your phone or tablet is broadcast live. You can talk about what you're doing, you can share your screen, you can add comments, you can do all these things, and the people that are viewing it can interact with you. They can like it, they can ask questions, they can leave comments. So it's kind of like Periscope, kind of like Twitch, all wrapped into this new kind of mobile frontier for live streaming.
How well does it work? I mean, what's the lag like when you're screen sharing? What you're doing from your app? How is that compared to, you know, a service like Twitch? Because that's always the big fear when you're doing stuff on mobile, that the overhead might be too high or there might be too much latency for the live stream. What's that like?
Yeah, so unfortunately, we're still kind of in early days. They've been working on this for a while, and when they launched it yesterday, it's still in beta for Android. iOS is coming soon. And in this beta testing, they're basically opening it up for people to use for several hours each day. They'll announce that on their Twitter stream. They'll announce that in the app. So people haven't been able to test it very extensively. The streams I've seen have been quite great, but I don't know what these people are experiencing on their end when I'm streaming. Basically, the community's still getting set up. The app is still being tested and still being innovated on. So we'll know a lot more about that once we, you know, get further along the development, once it becomes more of a launched official app. But you're right, it's a huge struggle with any kind of live streaming. I think Twitch has done a really great job. It's getting a lot better with bandwidth, getting a lot better. 4G LTE connectivity is getting better. Obviously, probably connecting to a Wi-Fi network is going to help. But, you know, we're still kind of waiting to kick the tires on this. We just know that it's here and that it's sort of working its way up to becoming the next like live streaming phenomenon.
I think they're pretty smart to not target it narrowly at gaming directly at Twitch, because of course Twitch and Google and YouTube Gaming can and probably will just throw a switch at some point and be able to do this kind of thing directly from a mobile with no tethers, no nothing. And so it's a good idea to sort of hedge their bet and make it a, sort of an all-purpose sharing streaming type of app. Now, how does Mirative plan to deal with the chat roulette problem where people share more of themselves than is probably appropriate?
Yeah, absolutely. I did ask the company, how are they going to deal with copyright stuff? Because you can open this up, put on any app or any thing on your screen. I mean, you could start streaming Netflix. You could start streaming Spotify. And that violates copyright protections. It doesn't make those companies very happy because some random person could get access to that content for not subscribing. And like you said, pornography could be an issue. Well, there's all sorts of different things. The company said that they have a team working out of Japan, where the company's based, that will be monitoring streams for inappropriate content, monitoring for copyright infractions, and just generally responding to, you know, users can reach out to them, let them know what they're seeing, and they will investigate that. But you're right, it's going to be an issue. That was Chat Roulette's issue. It's somewhat helped by the fact that you can't use your camera to record, although the front-facing camera works. So you can see, kind of like in a Skype interview, you can see that your viewers can see what your reactions are. But yeah, there's definitely going to be concerns there, and they say they're going to do the best they can to mitigate those.
Very cool. So I had one question about this. So DNA is the company who's behind this, right?
Yeah, it's DENA.
Right. And they're also the company that's doing the first licensed Nintendo mobile games. Weird, far off thing. And I know that maybe you won't know the answer to this, but entertain me for a second. What are the chances that they might build this technology into some of their mobile games, since they have mobile games? So the idea would be you could stream the games as you're playing them using this service and maybe interact with people. And if it were maybe a Nintendo branded thing, then it could be part of, you know, their Miiu service and some of the other things that they've got going on within the Nintendo ecosystem. What do you think about something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I obviously don't know whatever plans they have for that, but it wouldn't seem to be that difficult to integrate that. And I feel like in the future, this is just going to be built into most games. I mean, it's going to become a thing where it's built into, the functionality is built into your phone, it's built into your computer. It's becoming so widespread in the gaming community, and it will likely kind of riffle out from there, that I wouldn't be surprised if these features are just somehow built into the apps you download, the games you download, whatever you're playing, no matter where you're playing it, on a TV, on a console, on a computer, on a phone. You know, what's stopping them from kind of riffling out that technology and putting it where they want it to be?
Yeah, what's stopping them indeed? Now, while we were talking about this, Jason went to the Mirative site. And they have a notification. It says that the sneak peek will start August 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern time. And they say, during our beta phase, we've decided to set daily times when users can come and watch broadcasts on Mirative. So apparently they're narrowing the time of day that you can do this. It seems like it would make the problem worse by putting everybody in the same period of time. But they're already struggling with bandwidth, apparently. So very, very strange. Sarah Mitroff is at CNET.com and on Twitter at Sarah Mitroff. Sarah, thank you for joining us on Tech News Today.
Yeah, thank you guys.
All right. Well, the U.S. military wants to get in on the wearables revolution, and it's turning to Silicon Valley for help. The Pentagon announced today a $171 million award to a Silicon Valley consortium that includes Apple, of all companies. The consortium is called the Flex Tech Alliance, and it includes about 162 companies, universities, and nonprofits. The agreement will be managed by the U.S. Air Force Research Lab, and in addition to wearables, they'll also be helping the Pentagon with flexible electronics in general. And that includes technologies around, quote, high-end printing technologies to create stretchable electronics that could be embedded with sensors and worn by soldiers or used on ships or airplanes, according to a defense official quoted by Reuters. Christina Warren, this is one of those stories where I like to warn people about how the tech press tends to cover things. This is being reported in some circles and with some headlines as Apple's going to be, you know, helping the Pentagon design next generation uniforms or something like that. That's not really what happened. It's this consortium that already exists that companies like Apple and other research organizations are involved with. Lots of companies, lots of universities. And it also has to be said that $171 million is from Apple money, from Pentagon, like that's a tiny amount of money.
I was going to say that's not a lot of money. I mean, it's an interesting kind of, I guess, first test, you know, for some of this stuff. It certainly has potential, but you're right. I mean, for the Pentagon, that's certainly not a lot of money for them to, that's a minuscule amount of their budget. But it's interesting, you know, I mean, it's interesting that these companies are working together. And you have to think that all these companies in this consortium, and these researchers especially, have skill sets when it comes to designing, chipsets a certain way with miniaturization, with, some of the research that a lot of places are doing on flexible tech and in screens and displays and on embedded sorts of technologies and things like that. That's certainly something that I could see, being very useful to the Pentagon. But you're dead on. Anybody who's trying to say this as there's some sort of productized element or, Apple is working with the Pentagon to create something like that, that's not explicitly true. It's researchers and people who are already involved in this group that are going to be, maybe offering some of their expertise. I would assume more from a consulting basis and less of a, this is some of our actual, know-how, because the Pentagon has plenty of their own know-how there. I would assume that they would want just some, consulting on what's the best way maybe to approach some of the things that they're hoping to do with their, potentially their next generation uniforms, but beyond that too, also, putting different types of technology on, aircraft or tanks or jeeps or anything else.
Yeah, and my belief is that $171 million just gets the Pentagon into the meetings. And gets them introductions, because essentially what the Pentagon, they're not shy about spending money. They'll spend billions and trillions if they need to have an edge militarily. But essentially they can't just walk into Silicon Valley and start demanding to meet with people, because it's like, everybody in the Valley, everybody in private companies is going to be like, what's in it for me? I'm not planning to follow one of your contracts. I'm not involved in this at all. I don't, And so in order to get them into the door, they've got to drag some million-dollar bills around, and it works. And then they get in there and they get to meet everybody. They find out who's excited, who's working on interesting technologies that may make some acquisitions more likely. There'll be a VC for the right kinds of companies and have exclusive contracts to do certain things. That'll all happen behind the scenes. This is probably the last we'll hear about this until in five years they're going to announce a new uniform that is like a wearable technology device. That kind of thing. So this is how they do it.
It says on the back, designed in Cupertino.
Yeah, exactly. I doubt it. A federal appeals court has overturned a previous ruling we told you about that banned the NSA's bulk collection of phone metadata. So if you're feeling optimistic about the rollback of the NSA, it's time to feel despair again. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So at this point, what's the next process? Does this potentially go to the Supreme Court? What happens now?
It does. But what's interesting about this is that the according to some articles that I've read, and I'm not sure exactly how this works, but my belief is that this ruling means that for now, the NSA can just go for it. Like right now, like today.
There's not an injunction. They've basically lifted. They've gone back on it. Right. So, and at this point, since the court is no longer in session, assuming that they would even accept this case to begin with, I mean, there's a minimum of a year where they'll be able to just continue to go full hog on this thing. And hopefully the ACLU and some other groups are actively lobbying now to look about, appealing this to the next level.
I'm sure that's absolutely the case. And of course, we're heading into an election season, so everybody's going to be tough on defense, tough on terrorism, stuff like that. So it doesn't bode well for the future of personal privacy and so on. So
no, it doesn't.
So we'll see where this goes. Well, in product update news, Google will soon add a feature to its Chrome browser that will prevent videos from autoplaying in a tab that is not in the foreground. Hooray, Christina Warren.
Yeah, no, this is good. It's also going to prevent certain ads from running and other stuff. So if you've got Flash, I mean, it's been in the Chrome betas, I think, for a while, but it'll be out in the official Chrome release, which will be out on September 1st. That's on Tuesday. So good news, everybody. Less bad Flash stuff coming your way soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know about you, but I'm like crazy with the tabs. I've often got, 40 of them open at any given time.
Same.
And when that thing starts playing,
Nothing worse. The problem is, they have like the little like now playing logo in the tab, which is awesome. That's fantastic. Yeah. Here's the problem. If you've got 40 of them open, you can't see.
Exactly.
the icon is too small to actually see which one is playing. So you're like,
tell me.
Stop.
Yeah. Tell me something I don't know. It's it's fine. I usually just mute my whole laptop until I eventually get
to
that tab.
I just mute the whole thing. But then I'm like, if I'm not on power, then I'm like, okay, well, now this is sucking up my battery. Thanks a lot. Like, no, stop.
Yeah.
And there's certain websites that are the worst, where you'll go to them and then they the browser ad starts you know, playing something completely unrelated. And then the news websites are bad too. You know, you go to abcnews.com, and I like ABC a lot, but I hate the freaking autoplay every time I'm on a news article, because I might just open it up in the background, and then the next thing I know, I hear, you know, like George Stephanopoulos or someone speaking. I'm like, stop talking to me.
Yeah.
So this is great news.
Yeah, it's great news. And you referenced the other part of this, which is another exciting thing, which is that like Amazon did recently. Well, Amazon yeah. recently announced that they would ban, starting September 1st, all flash ads on the Amazon.com site. I don't know. Do they have advertising on Amazon.com other than Amazon's own advertising?
They do. It is limited, but you do actually see it sometimes below the fold and some of the you might also like. They will sometimes go to outside retailers or sometimes to other Amazon things. But you will see sometimes, like if you're looking at a Mophie case, you might actually see like a link that goes to Mophie.com because Mophie might buy advertising there.
I see.
I've seen the same thing where I've actually seen advertising take me to the manufacturer sites. I've even seen it sometimes taking me to like off Amazon sites, but in general, it's more limited, but yeah. still.
And so Google is following suit by, they're not going to ban Flash outright. They're actually doing the right thing. And it's kind of a surprising move for a company that lives and dies by advertising. If you go to a website that's like, oh, look at this video, and the main point of the page is a video you want to watch, and that's a Flash video, it'll show that to you. But
sure.
If the ads around the periphery our Flash ads, they're going to block those. Again, starting September 1st, it's going to be that's going to be the default behavior now. That's the difference. It's now the default behavior. And if you want to go in and say, no, I want all the Flash ads, you can go into your browser, your Chrome browser.
No one's going to do that.
Nobody's going to do it.
No one's going to do that. What's really interesting, I think, is what's going to happen here is this is really going to force the ad industry, which has been very slow, slower than a lot, than they frankly should have been, because there have been so many alternatives to Flash advertising that have been around for years to fully embrace non-Flash advertising stuff. And the biggest, offenders are these kind of lower level advertising networks that are, you know, work more on an arbitrage basis, where oftentimes, you know, websites, including Mashable, I should note, you know, have them kind of backfilled in, and we don't always know what ads are running at every specific time. But a lot of times, you know, they're Flash ads and they're lower quality and they're resource intensive. And this is going to force the ad industry at large to really start adopting these new technologies faster and faster and do the right thing. The downside of that, of course, is that we will probably see an uptick in some of the nastier HTML5 types of ads where they do the redirects. And if you're on mobile, we'll try to take you to the App Store, and we'll try to do pop-ups and that sort of thing. But that's what iOS 9 content blockers are for. So there's a tick and talk to everything. But I think this is a great move on Google's behalf. And I'm with you. I'm surprised they're doing this since they are so reliant on advertising. But I also feel like this is a good opportunity for them to kind of probably with some of their own ad products, kind of lead the way and say, hey, we're doing things the right way. You can have the same sort of engagement and the same sort of serving capabilities without using this technology, which is at this point, frankly, unsafe to use, which is the biggest, you know, rationale against using Flash. Not only is it not going to display on mobile and you'll have to use a fallback, but it's unsafe to use.
Yeah. And it's in fairness, in unfairness to Google, I guess maybe it would be more appropriate. I probably shouldn't praise them too much, because to a certain extent, they're saving ads here. People are adding ad blockers because of all the things you described that are the security and performance issues around Flash ads. So they're trying to sort of head off the ad blockers and make advertising go down a little easier. And so it's not a sacrifice on their part. It's actually...
No, I mean, it is. It's like they've got to give up, maybe hurt a little bit now so that they don't hurt later. All I want is, you know, there have been a lot of people who've been testing out, including myself, some of the content blockers on iOS 9. And it is ridiculous in this day and age when a website you visit is 15 megabytes on mobile. This is why people run out of data, you know, on their mobile plans. It's not because you're streaming videos. It's because you're trying to load a news website and it's 15 megabytes.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We got some more really interesting news coming right up. But first, let's talk about our other sponsor today, which is Little Bits. What is Little Bits? Little Bits is an amazing set of products. It's a whole bunch of different products that let you build your own and program your own electronic devices. Now, everybody talks about how, you know, we have this digital divide in technology. We have a lack of diversity, not very many women in technology. And if you trace the problem back to its root, the root of the problem is that our culture tells girls, when they're still girls, that engineering and technology is for other people. not for girls. And so instead of, you know, the holidays are coming, instead of giving the gift of a doll or some dumb gift like that to the girl, in the little girl in your life, give her the gift of engineering. Give her the promise of learning how to be a NASA engineer or astronaut. Here's an example of just that shows how easy this is. If you look at little bits, this is the space kit, for example. They have multiple kits. But if you look at how easily these come apart, one thing you don't want to do, I don't recommend that you give a soldering gun to a nine-year-old. Don't recommend it. This doesn't require soldering or anything like it. It's just simple magnets allow you to complete circuits and build very simple things or complex things based on what it is, the imagination of the person using it. And of course, this isn't just for kids, it's for adults too. But you can do, you know, basic things, and you string these things together, and you can actually build anything from a very simple alarm or switch all the way up to a gigantic robot that will help you conquer the universe. Little Bits is a fantastic product, partly because of the flexibility. They have over 60 modules, and these can be used in virtually limitless creative combinations. The base and deluxe kits are the perfect way to get kids excited about learning and playing with electronics. The space kit, the one that's right here, was developed in partnership with NASA, right? They want the world to produce future engineers as well, and they're helping by working with Little Bits to produce these amazing fun toys. The Arduino coding kit introduces children to software programming. They build the hardware and then they program it, and it's just a great thing. And the Tinker and Deluxe kits includes 18 modules that snap together with billions of circuits. This is a rare product that's aimed at people of all ages above a certain age. I mean, obviously you're not going to give this to a toddler, but this is for people who are 60. It's for people who are young kids, it's for high school kids, for middle school kids. It's for anybody who wants to explore the amazing world of electronics, engineering, software programming, and that sort of thing. Using the Arduino coding kit, everybody can program and manipulate physical Little Bit outputs and manipulate what's on the screen using Little Bit's input. You know, in the early days of computer programming, the input was a switch and the output was a blinking light. Little Bits gives you far, far more capabilities, so much flexibility. Nobody can predict what a creative mind can do with a Little Bit kit like this. Little Bits is offering new customers $20 off their first kit. It's a great deal. Just go to littlebits.com/TNT plus free shipping in the U.S. That's littlebits.com/TNT. And if you make something with Little Bits, post it on Instagram and send me the link or the hashtag or something. I'd love to see it. That's Little Bits, and we thank Little Bits for their support of Tech News Today. Well, in the wake of their massive hacking scandal, the CEO of Ashley Madison's parent company is stepping down. Avid Life Media chief Noel Biderman, in fact, has already left the company to spend more time with his mistress.
Or which one? Yeah, no. Why are we surprised?
Yeah.
Why did it take this long is my big question.
Yeah. This is a sleazy company, and
company, and they are screwed. They're absolutely screwed. There's another word I could use. I won't use it because we're a family show, but they are screwed as a company. Their attempts, they were trying to do an IPO because they need the funding, frankly. that's not going to happen.
Yeah. They not only did a whole bunch of shady things, but they were just profoundly anti-marriage. Profoundly, you know, it wasn't just that they were offering an option for people who might be looking for an affair or something like that. They were actively and aggressively against marriage. I mean, it was really kind of an ugly company. So
it was a pretty gross company. And then my big thing is, you know, they were selling themselves as the one safe space online, the one safe space. Like, to me, that at that point, this obviously came from some internal people, which is their fault, frankly. I mean, do a better job vetting your people and do a better job securing your own stuff so that if someone internally is trying to take your data and take down your company, you're aware of it. But beyond that, I mean, don't tout your security ability if you can't keep your stuff secure, because that's just asking to be hacked in this day and age. That's just asking for it.
Yeah, and a couple of people in the chat room are saying, oh, they're not sleazy just because people have a different lifestyle and so on. No, they're sleazy. They were working on an app. We learned in the revelations from this hack that they were working on an app called What's Your Wife Worth, where people would put a monetary value on other people's wives.
That's disgusting.
This is sleazy. Okay, this isn't about people making choices about their own sex life.
Exactly.
This is a sleazy company.
No, if you want to use a service like this, I'm not going to actually judge you. I don't know your situation. I don't know your relationship. It's not my place to judge. But this company was gross. I mean, the fact that they had a guaranteed a fair plan.
Yeah.
You know, you pay $250 and you're guaranteed an affair within 3 months or you get your money back. I mean, that's almost tantamount. I'm not going to say that it is the equivalent of an escort service, but it's pretty close. I mean, that's gross. You know, putting values on people's, you know, spouses. That's just, they're a gross company. They touted themselves as being secure. They touted, you know, they made money and made their reputation on their grossness. They liked the fact that they tried to get and failed at getting Super Bowl ads. You know, they wanted to be risque. They capitalized on it. And then as soon as, you know, this happened, they went radio silent. And all the people who've used the service, I mean, that's the worst part, is that they're the general, it's not that the famous people and the schadenfreude we get, those people, you know what, your public figure, you get what you get. This is what happens. But the regular people who, for whatever reason, are in those situations, I mean, people's lives are potentially ruined. And this company is not going to be held responsible. They're not going to be held accountable. The CEO has stepped down. And the one good thing that might come from this is that a company that clearly didn't care about its stated mission, whatever we may think of that mission, didn't do a good job protecting its users' information. And despite pretending that it was above everyone else, and it's probably going to go out of business. And I'm not going to be sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And good luck, Noel Biderman, on your next job.
Yeah.
All right. So we have a gigantic number for you. This is a really, really big number.
Yeah, it is.
The number is 1 billion. And it's a big number because that's how many people used Facebook on Monday, all in a single day. 1 billion actual users on a single day. And this was according to a post from CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
Insane.
They must be stopped, Christina Warren. They have just way too many users.
No, I mean, 1 billion like users in one day. That's, as he said, that's one in seven people on the freaking planet. Yeah. And when you consider the number of people who still on this planet that still don't have access to the internet or electricity or modern amenities or any of that, this is ridiculous. From Harvard dorm room to this.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. They have what I've called a monopoly on everybody. That's their main business plan. They are the only place that has everybody. And you mentioned one in seven people, and it's not just one in seven people taking into consideration of the fact that the majority of the population doesn't have access to the internet. That's including infants, people in comas.
Yes, right, exactly. You know, keeping in mind that a certain percentage of these people are not old enough to have Facebook accounts or be on the computer. You're exactly right. I mean, it's insane. If we were to take the actual like age people who are allowed to have Facebook accounts, then it would probably be like 1 in 5, 1 in 4, which is even more astounding.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Pramod Padmati in Hyderabad, India, who posted this picture on Twitter. Looking good, Pramod. Very cool.
Very nice.
Love to see it. All right. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. And use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. And you know what? I get a lot of email from fans in India. We got a ton of people watching in India. And so
India.
If you're in India, you know, we got one fan of the day pick from somebody who watches on the commute, and they have a streaming video on the back of the car where they carpool into work and they watch it on the way to work. However, if you're in India, I want to call out to you especially. Take a picture right now of how you're watching TNT and post it anywhere and use the hashtag so we can find it and love to see it. Christina Warren, what the heck are you working on these days?
Okay, well, since we last talked, I did finally finish my Carly Fiorina piece that went up on Monday. Yeah. That went up on Monday. But what I'm working on right now, because it's now Apple silly season, I mean, IFA's next week, Berlin, there's going to be stuff happening there. But let's be honest, everyone's just going to be speculating what Apple's going to announce. So they're doing this thing at the Bill Graham Civic Center, which has an enormous 7,000 person capacity, which is insane.
Yeah.
So I'm working on a post right now where I'm basically trying to come up with all the reasons why Apple might need a space that big.
Yeah. Yeah. For Johnny Ive's ego needs its own section.
you know, I'm hoping that, that there will be some sort of live performance. I was really going to hold out for Taylor Swift. Unfortunately, she's performing in Texas that night, and there's just with the time delay, there's no way that that'll work. So I'm convinced that Taylor Swift will not be there. That would have truly been my dream come true, because it would have been everything that I care about.
Yeah, be able to retire.
I would be able to retire. It'd be like between that and interviewing Tim Cook earlier this year. Like, I genuinely would be like, okay, I'm done. but no, that's not going to happen. But I mean, there may be Bono, and I'm kidding. They're not going to bring Bono back. So I'm working on a post basically theorizing. It's a little tongue in cheek and a little serious about like, okay, what are they going to do with this venue? Because this place is huge. This is not Moscone West.
Yeah.
This is a big, big place. So we'll see.
My theory is that it's going to be the additional space is going to be used for partners, that they're launching something that's going to require huge buy-in, maybe Apple TV and the home automation stuff that goes with that, or maybe a combination of multiple things that require multiple partners, or maybe everybody in Hollywood's going to be there because they're doing some big thing with television, or who knows? I mean, we've heard plenty of rumors and speculation about how their TV streaming has been delayed and all that kind of stuff, but I think that the phone is everything we're expecting.
Yes.
And then it's going to be something else.
Something else
is going to need a lot of partners. And then they bring everybody in because, of course, everybody wants to be in the keynote.
Totally. Maybe they drive them out in a car.
Yeah, yeah. And to a bad section of town. I don't know what we're looking at there. What is that? Is that that's the venue?
Yeah, this is the venue. That's what I'm saying. Maybe they drive a car into the venue.
Yeah.
I'm saying, like, they have, like, you know.
A clown car.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying an Apple car, but maybe they do CarPlay. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Like, so you're not saying an Apple car. An Apple car is what you're not saying.
That's what I'm not saying.
Okay. So don't say that, because then you would not be not saying it. All right, Christina Warren. Well, thank you so much for calling in today. Great stuff as always, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time, Mike.
All right. Bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on TuneIn, or you can choose any other way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. If you're ever in the San Francisco Bay Area, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Just send email to tickets@twit.tv before you come in. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me at Elgin.com. Also, don't miss our other tech news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. The show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Kevin King. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. I'll see you Monday. Not tomorrow. You're not going to see me. You will see me tomorrow. I'm on Screensavers. But I'll see you here Monday.